Yeah. Look at that thing. This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. The question always comes up occasionally. If you travel around university campuses, either as a parent with your youngster in tow, or maybe if you happen to be a local person, like in this case here in Hammond or maybe Westville, what's happening at the Purdue University Northwest campus these days? It's not the regular school year, so to speak, but there are things that are happening on campus, and a lot of times it's getting ready for the next year. Well, let's find out more. We'll ask the not-so-burning but certainly interesting question of Richard Rupp, who is the Chief of Staff for Purdue University Northwest Chancellor Thomas Kean's office. And, Richard, thanks for being with us today.
Well, thanks very much, Chris. I'm happy to be on the show with you. I did hear your intro, and I've been seeing students and parents all summer long here, as it happens. So we're still very much operating on a 12-month calendar, even though we don't have our full complement of classes going for the summer months.
Yeah, that's what we notice here, that we've got the graduation ceremonies taken care of, and the students who are continuing on for another year of classes at Purdue Northwest will be coming back in the fall, of course.
Sure.
Actually, late summer, really, because that's when classes activity starts to pick back up again, I know, before the fall semester begins. And we know, too, that there are other things that happen on the campuses in both cities, both in Hammond as well as in Westville, I'm sure, and other activities regardless of whether it's summer classes or camps or whatever it may be, you've got to get ready for that next school year coming up here. Walk us through the process, if you will. We'll say that that the commencement happened or the end of the semester happened. What happens on campus at that point when there's no longer classes for students to attend or, for that matter, for professors and assistant professors and associate professors to teach?
Sure. Well, I would say actually that summer begins well before the summer. So we do a heck of a lot of planning throughout actually the academic year as to what's going to be happening in the summer. So we have not only our summer teaching going on, you know, we're a student-centered organization, and so teaching's our focus, and we actually have about 501 to be precise, classes offered this summer in the Westville and the Hammond campuses. So I can talk to you a little bit today about the student experiences that are going on campus, and
okay.
I'll talk to you a little bit about what the faculty's up to, and then talk to you just about, we've got some great infrastructure stories, we've got the Sinai Forum, we've got athletics. So I guess in a nutshell for your readers, we don't want you to think that we take the summer off. Summer is a very busy time at PNW. Gives us time to plan for the coming year and also execute the plans that we've got going for the summer months.
One of the things I know that that people may be aware of and may not be aware of, there are, of course, summer camps that are set up, as you've mentioned in the remarks here about the Purdue Northwest campuses, things happening on campus like the SLAM camp and the cybersecurity camp. Tell us how these get organized and how they fit into the summer months.
Sure. Sounds like, Chris, both of us have done our homework, because I was briefed by the staff this morning about all our summer camps. So it sounds like you've had the same folks working for you.
Well, I just have a very short list here, so I'll let you explain it.
Well, we have about five or six significant camps going on. A number of them are within the STEM fields, and they service a variety of students and mission goals. Some of our summer camps, actually, one of them with Dr. Abramowitz, focuses on high school teachers and focusing on STEM preparation and how to teach STEM creatively from a university perspective to high school teachers so they can bring those skills in the classroom. So actually this week we've got quite a few science, chemistry, mathematics, engineering high school teachers from around the area, and I think actually from around the state, working with our faculty, showing our faculty, learning from the high school teachers, the high school teachers learning from our faculty about how to engage students. And as you mentioned, we also have our cybersecurity camp, which is new for us, but very much part of what we're building as a niche at Purdue Northwest, is that cybersecurity is, I guess I should say, unfortunately, a major concern now of all nations, and it's a pretty interesting market niche. And so this summer we're actually reaching out to high school students, exposing them to the future of forensic science. We have a camp just on forensic science and then the camp on cybersecurity, so that the kids can see that, you know, this is the world they're entering into, and these are potentially very exciting career opportunities, and that Purdue Northwest might be just the place they want to be to pursue these. But we also don't want—I don't want to leave out my friends in the humanities and the social sciences. You noted that we also have an art slam, and that's down in Michigan City, close to the Westville campus, and that's a week of intense writing and theater and performances. So we try to reach out to a variety of student audiences during the summer with our faculty. And you had asked, you know, how do we pick? Well, we go with areas of considerable excellence for us, and so that's where STEM comes in. And we've had a lot of faculty who have developed skill sets and reaching out to younger people, because we want to excite them about the sciences and about the possibilities for their future. So that's and to be perfectly blunt, of course, this is a way of attracting students to Purdue Northwest, because they're going to see our campuses, they're going to see our faculty, and hopefully we're going to inspire them and bring them into the university setting.
I know that even during the summer months in particular, I know there's one camp that has just happened, just finished up here not long ago, actually wasn't even on campus, on either campus for that matter, too. It actually happened at the Arboretum that people know better as Talltree. Tell us about the camps that happened over at the Arboretum this summer.
Well, that's very exciting what's going on at Gabus this year, because now, you know, the long-term, the Arboretum was long known as the Talltree Arboretum, and now this year, you know, 2018 was a huge year for the university on a number of fronts. And one of those fronts was the gift of the Arboretum by the Gabus family. And that was a $12 million gift to the university. And so this year we've actually gone kind of slow, Chris, with how we've been incorporating the Arboretum into our mission, because mm-hmm. we really want to honor what the Gabus family and the wonderful staff and the volunteers have done. But we're gradually bringing in our faculty and our researchers to see what sort of opportunities are at the Arboretum for the university.
I know, too, that besides this opportunity to have a kind of an off-campus camp and taking advantage of the Arboretum, there have been sports camps that have been set up and in operation and continuing on, I guess, through the summer months, too, I understand.
Right. We basically did not want to make any changes to the Arboretum's functioning this first year, because
right.
you know, we didn't want to feel like we're the 900-pound gorilla and we were coming in and running the show. We really wanted to honor what has been going on, and so we've all the programs that were underway were continuing, and I think in the coming year we're going to be adding to them. And you know, there are sports programs out there. You know, I've been out there with the chancellor, and we look at those magnificent running paths. We're thinking maybe as long as it doesn't do any damage to the ecosystem out there, we'd like to see our athletics program perhaps train out there a little bit. I think you'll see us do Shakespeare in the Park next year, because there's that lovely amphitheater out there. And we're also thinking about a writer's workshop. I know that our English department's moving in that direction. So we're gradually going to be having a greater presence at Gabus, and really want to highlight this extraordinary gift, because when the family turned the Arboretum over to the university, basically very quickly we became one of the largest owners of an Arboretum in the university Arboretum in the United States. So most arboretums, if you look at them, are reasonably small within universities, but Gabus is 300 beautiful acres.
We're talking with the Purdue Northwest Chancellor's Chief of Staff, Richard Rupp, about the activities that happen on both the Hammond and the Westville campuses and connected to the campuses during the summer months, in the time in between the commencement for one graduating class and maybe the start of a freshman class in the following academic year. And I know that, Richard, we talk here about the summer events and a lot of things still happening as the summer continues on. It's also an opportunity, I know, too, on both campuses for crews to be able to get out there, do some maintenance, and do some rehabilitation work, too. And a lot of that, I know, is set up in conjunction with what is coordinated through the main campus in West Lafayette, isn't it?
Well, West Lafayette's involved, but it's pretty much our operation over here. I would say Steve Turner, who is our director of these sorts of operations, is pretty well fully in control of the major operations, and I should say major operations. And Steve's quite attentive to even the grounds. And I very seldom see weeds on this campus, because
oh, yeah.
he's so attentive. But his big operation this year, of course, is the Bioscience and Innovation Building. That's for us. That was a major achievement that took many years to pull off. And in 2018, the legislature came forward with $35 million for an appropriation to build this really astounding state-of-the-art facility on the Hammond campus. And it actually will probably run us $40, $45 million. But it is a major accomplishment for the university, and really a major testament that the state of Indiana and our donors are making about the future of the university. And so we spent this last year with the architects and with our nurses and our biologists mapping out what will be a 68,000 square foot facility. And I happen to be in the chancellor's office right now, and I'm looking down, and I'm looking at the parking lot, which is going to be very different in about 2 months' time. We'll have you out here, Chris, for the groundbreaking in August, and we're going to lose about 250 parking spots, but we're going to replace it with a really great facility.
Well, we know, too, that for many people who are not only graduates of Purdue Northwest or its predecessor, Purdue Calumet, they remember, Mary, I'm sure, very fondly attending classes at Guite Hall, and then we know this is the new Guite, will be, I guess, the new Guite Hall, if you want to look at it that way, too.
There, you could look at it that way. I think the folks who have worked in Guite for many years, I suppose, have fond memories, but I think we'll actually be demolishing Guite. I think we're scheduled for 2020 for that, and then set sail for new construction. Because as you say, you know, this is a time of the year when we do have extra time to focus on maintenance at the university. The Westville campus is absolutely pristine, and we're making improvements. Always ongoing improvements at the Westville campus. We have maybe a little bit more work to do up here at the Hammond campus, a little bit older campus. Just, you know, what we're doing with the bioscience, there are other projects going along. It feels very busy, and sometimes it feels a little bit like a construction site, but it's all good.
Well, when you have these projects underway like this and planning not only for future buildings, as it works here, but the maintenance and the rehabilitation projects that you, I guess, can only put off until summer months when there isn't the crowd of students on campus, you have this opportunity to be able to plan for the year ahead. You, as you say, as part of the ongoing and rather continuing process, I suppose, in getting ready now for the next academic year, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, maybe I'll say a little bit about what our faculty is up to.
Yeah, please.
Because of course, they don't take the summer off. I've been a faculty member here. I've been chief of staff for now about a year and a half, but I've been faculty here for 20 years. And I very seldom remember long summers on Cape Cod. So we're usually very busy, be it teaching the summer courses. It's a great time for us to really power down and get time in for our research and our scholarship and publishing. But actually, what we also do on campus, so we regularly have large numbers of faculty on campus, because we usually take this time to take a deep look at ourselves. So we have, for example, our Center for Faculty Development, which is headed by Dr. Emily Hickson. And Dr. Hickson leads workshops throughout the summer, giving faculty very focused workshops, giving faculty time to focus perhaps on something like digital learning. We offer certificates. A faculty member can only teach a distance class at Purdue Northwest if they've received a certificate. And it's a very involved process. I did it myself a number of years ago to see how it all works. It's mm-hmm. fascinating, but it's very, you know, it's very different. I started teaching 30 years ago with, you know, plastic overheads, which I was very comfortable with. But teaching has to be up to date, and it's not only that teaching has to be up to date. That is to say, the technology, so that the faculty is aware of new pedagogies. But you really have to understand the mindset of an 18, 19, 20 year old as well. And, you know, I'm 54, and I've spent a lot of my life with 18, 19, and 20 year olds, but, you know, they change. And this generation is very different than the generation that I started teaching 25, 30 years ago. And so we spend time in the summer really having long conversations about who are our students, how are they learning. You know, I was just in our university library, and we have a lovely library, but, you know, the library is very different than it was years ago. We still very much have a physical library with books, but, you know, it's an online world out there, and so we have to be up to how students process information.
Well, it looks like we have I'm sorry, go ahead.
I was also going to say, along the lines of how we engage students with the faculty, just this week, we have a terrific program headed by Dr. Paul Hecht, in which we actually train rather senior members of the faculty on the arts, on the science of teaching freshman seminar courses, because we have every year we have a large number of incoming freshmen, and we want them to have a great experience, and we want them to stay. And we're a public university, and like public universities around the country, always a certain percentage of the incoming class decides that perhaps college isn't for them. And what we want to make sure that we do everything that we can to say that if you have the prospects for success, we want to make sure that you have the opportunities here on campus. And so this summer, probably about 20 faculty are being going through a pretty rigorous set of seminars about how to anchor those students into the campus experience. As you know, about two-thirds of our students are first-generation college students, and that it takes a while to learn how to be a college student. And so we do this very intensely, and we're delighted with the program that we've got going, and it's been showing results. I actually taught in it. My last class that I'll teach here for a while after I became chief of staff or before was a class along those lines, and I taught a team talk class with Lisa Goodnight, who's our incoming Vice Chancellor of Advancement. So we put two pretty senior faculty members in with these incoming students, because we want to demonstrate that's our level of commitment to parents and to students.
And what did the students have to think about that?
Did
they say?
Well, Lisa... Part of it is helping them discover their voice, Chris, because that's part of college, and it's imperative for students, as I say, to develop their voice, because if they sit in the back of the room and don't participate, they may be smart as all heck, but I don't know them by the end of the semester if we're not developing a relationship. So I think the students might find us perhaps occasionally a little too in their face, because we really need to understand them and help bring them out. But I would say I see these students the next semester, and we because of the intimacy of our freshman-level classes, we genuinely get to know the students, which I think is absolutely pivotal to making sure they have a good first year.
Well, Richard, we're going to have to continue this conversation. Certainly, the closer we get to the start of the next academic year, we definitely will. We've been talking with the Purdue Northwest Chancellor's Chief of Staff, Richard Rupp, who has spent many years as a member of the faculty at Purdue Northwest here, as well as being in the administration, talking about what happens on the Westville and the Hammond campuses during the summer months. And as always, Richard, thank you for joining us, and we'll have you back on again real soon, I hope.
My pleasure, Chris. You have a great rest of the day.
Thank
Bye-bye.
You very much. You're listening to Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. This next story comes to you from the Welcome Project at Valparaiso University. The Welcome Project collects first-person stories and pairs these with intentional conversation to help forge stronger ties within and across our communities.
The first neighborhood that I remember growing up in was on the east side of Gary, on Massachusetts Street. And my parents brought me home from the hospital there. And I lived there until I was 4 and a half, just about 5 years old. And it was a very tight-knit community. I remember the families all interacted. The other thing about the neighborhood I remember, there were people from all walks of lives. My dad was a teacher. Across the street, my mother's best friend was my physician. We had other teachers on the block. We had people that worked in the steel mill. And all of us lived in one community. And that allowed, I think, growing up, people to see that all of these things were attainable. I think that's part of what doesn't happen today, because once people get to a certain financial level, they tend to move away from the original community. I've never used that term, black flight, but I think there are a lot of things involved with that. Certainly people have a tendency, if they make a certain amount of money, to want to live in a different home. In this area, there are nice, beautiful homes in different sections of Gary, in Miller, for instance, even on the west side of Gary, there are some beautiful homes, But a lot of times people have felt like they want to live in another community. I think the media has played a big role in that because they have demonized this community for so long that people bought into this notion that no one wants to live in Gary and that Gary is unsafe and this is not somewhere that you would want to live. And particularly if you've gotten to the point where you want to have put a lot of money into a home, you would not want to put that money into Gary. And then, of course, we have to discuss the crime. But the crime is associated to the jobs. And so when you take jobs out of a community and you replace those jobs with guns and money, then you have something that's volatile. And as a result, then you start to, you know, have these notions that I can't live a safe life. I think the white flight really is based on racism. Purely racism. I don't care that I live in a nice home. I don't care what the community looks like, if it's predominantly black or if there's even some blacks. I would prefer not to live there and or do business there. And that is what really has happened to Gary, Indiana.
You can find more regional stories at welcomeproject.valpo.edu. Over the last couple decades, research shows that the number of teens getting behind the wheel is down significantly, but it's difficult to know exactly why. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Lindsay Wright reports that there is some evidence to show that more recently the trend might be reversing.
Jalen Mann is a junior at Indiana University. He's your average college student, except when it comes to one aspect of his life. He doesn't have a driver's license.
I do have a learner's permit, but that's only because I needed a form of ID for my 21st birthday.
Mann prefers walking. He says, unlike his friends, he just never took an interest in driving, and he still gets picked on for it. It shows as he and his roommate talk about it in the kitchen.
Didn't you feel bad, like asking them all the time, hey, can you pick me up? Hey, can I get a ride? Oh, I want to go hang out.
They'll just kind of look at me for a second and be like, you don't even have a license. I don't know what you're talking. Like, you shouldn't be talking or contributing to the conversation.
Although it sounds unusual, Mann isn't the only one skipping out on the typical 16-year-old's dream. According to a study published in the journal Child Development, in the late 1970s, 88% of high school seniors had a driver's license. That's dropped to about 73% during the past several years. The reason for the significant drop in adolescents driving isn't exactly clear. But Greg Sider, the public affairs manager with the Hoosier Motor Club, says it seems the economy plays a big role.
The finances involved in not only obtaining a license, but then in driving a vehicle, those numbers in and of themselves were what we believe were pulling kids away from wanting to get their license.
Sider says the AAA Foundation for Traffic Safety found the biggest reason for teens holding off on getting their license is that they don't have a car.
There's obviously a direct connection in the ability of teenagers being able to find jobs or to have some sort of income and connecting that then to their willingness and eagerness to obtain a driver's license.
Put in the ignition, go ahead and start it up, but let's not do anything else yet.
Bernard Sissel has been teaching driver education for the last 20 years. As he sits in the passenger seat, he gives detailed instructions while one of his students operates the car.
Let's go left up here into the lot.
Sissel says he loves working with the teens.
Driver education is one of those things. If they're taking driver ed, they're certainly interested in the subject material and they're wanting to learn.
But he says there are a number of reasons teens put off this rite of passage.
It could be because, you know, there's not a need in the family. There may, you know, mom drives, dad drives, they got an older brother, sister that drives, and maybe they just don't have the interest to want to learn.
Not only is driver education expensive, costing at least a few hundred dollars, he says it's not as accessible as it used to be because it was previously mandated by the Department of Education.
Back years ago, all the high schools had their own driver education program, and it was typically the physical education department staff that would go out and teach the kids as a regular part of the school day.
That's not the case anymore, and Sissel says that makes it more challenging for teens. But Sider says recent car accident data shows a possible uptick in the number of teens getting their licenses.
Because there are more teenagers being involved in accidents on the roadway, we can take from that that there are more teenagers driving. So that's a variable right there.
While that's an anecdotal example of how the trend could be changing, it's unclear if that's what's really happening. And still, there are many people like Mann, the college student who loves to walk everywhere, who don't have a specific reason for not getting their license. They just simply have no desire. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Lindsay Wright.
Driver education, by the way, is not required in the state of Indiana, but it does dictate if a driver can get their license. And these days, there's online options out there, which does make it a little more accessible. You're listening to Regionally Speaking on listener-supported Lakeshore Public Radio. In studio with us for our occasional chat is Northwest Indiana activist Ruth Needleman. Ruth, thanks for joining us, as always.
Well, as always, my pleasure. And I have good news this time. I usually come with dreadful news.
What's the good news this time?
We have an initiative for people who have been affected by trauma. Mm-hmm. And if you think about this area, the enormous amount of environmental contamination, the drug wars, the mass incarceration, police killings, poverty, unemployment. This is not just a problem for our society and for people. It causes trauma. A lot of people don't think of trauma in that way, but many, many things can cause trauma. And what trauma does is it actually shuts down your rational brain and relies on what's called your reptilian brain, the little piece of instinct at the back of your head. And so people who are controlled by that brain do impulsive things to protect themselves. They protect themselves from dangers that are not there, which ends up in isolation, depression, and all kinds of problems. And obviously, it's not just a psychological problem, it's a physical problem. Mm-hmm. There's a wonderful book called The Body Holds the Score by Vander Kolk, who is the leading psychiatrist in the field of new forms of treating trauma. And we are going to open one right in Gary and in Northwest Indiana. So we have a group of people who have set up something called the Hope Center. HOPE stands for Haven of Peace and Empowerment. And such a place exists in the Black community in Boston called Roxbury. So we flew three people in here to talk about it. And they did an evening presentation, a morning presentation about how to do community-based, community and trauma-informed healing. And we had over 80 people come.
Wow.
Actually, maybe even closer to 90 people come. And they came because they know what a problem trauma is and how much it hurts people and makes them feel like there's something wrong with them, but they have nowhere to turn. They certainly can't turn to a $150 psychiatrist because a lot of these people have no health care. So what we did is these folks came, including the woman whose son was murdered and after which their center is named, the Corey Johnson Center. And she talked about how this helped her after the murder of her son and how they train community people to be companions, to help people. And they do programs that are collective, not individual, and that involve not only the mind and the body, but the spirit and the soul. So they have breathing, they have music, they have art, and they have a program, which is what we'll start with, called Can We Talk? People come, they serve a free dinner, then they have a saxophone player from I mean, he is fabulous. I heard it on the video. Mm-hmm. And then people can stand up and share stories if they want. And what happens after one or two people do it, and we had a simulation in both our meetings, is other people stand up and share something that's been very painful for them. And the impact of this, of recognizing that you're not alone, that there are other people to help you who have gone through similar things, is very powerful. So we had over, I think, 45 people say, we want to be trained so that whatever it is we do can be trauma-informed. And we will have child care workers, we will have kitchen workers, we will have janitorial workers and community companions, and we will pay them. A minimum, this was my argument, I won, $15 an hour minimum wage. But also, this training will be at the end of August. And we are very excited. The first place where we will have Can We Talk will be at Reverend John Jackson's church, Trinity United Church of Christ, on Lincoln and 20th Avenue. Mm-hmm. And we will also then be recruiting people who want to work. If you want to do childcare, you will get paid and you will be trained. And we set up a budget. We laid out a year plan, and it looks like the folks in Boston will be coming back here August 25th, free of charge to us because they got a grant to spread their program. And so they will do a two-day training on the 25th and 26th. Again, we will feed people, and we will take care of you. And if you come, you will be able to be a community partner, a child-informed child care worker, whatever you do for this program, you will get paid. Because if there's one thing that people in this area need, is paid employment, and not at $7.25 an hour.
When you talk about looking to getting some assistance to keep the program going, are there any plans, or at least I'm sure there's been some discussion far in the work about for the Hope Center to get some grants to find the foundations or other organizations to help keep it going?
We had an anonymous donation that will keep us going for at least a year.
Mm-hmm.
But we also are looking to partner with Health Net. Not to get money from them, because they are rich in people, poor in money. But they will refer people to us. They will give us help on finding employees. And we're going to explore the Boston, for example, program gets money from the main hospitals in Boston. And it's a very competitive atmosphere here. We want support from hospitals, but this is a different kind of program than what they do. We don't want someone saying, I'll help you if I can take it over.
Yeah.
This will always be grassroots, community-based collective healing. And whether you are a survivor of the Iraq or Vietnam War, whether you were raped as a child, any of these things, we will provide a support network that will help you move through the pain and be able to have better relationships with people, feel better about yourself, stop blaming yourself for the problems you experience. And, you know, in schools, when children are hyperactive, they give them medication. Very often that hyperactivity is the result of trauma. And they never look into it, and all they do is medicate. Personally, I've been on medication for over 20 years, and I've talked my heart out because I'm a trauma survivor. And somebody once asked me, well, did it help? I said, I really understand my trauma, but no, it did not help. But I can see how this makes a difference because it connects you to community. And often that's what's missing in survivors' lives.
Do you think that in addition to not only bringing the community together to talk about the problems and helping people deal with the traumas that they face, this may have a side benefit in dealing with such things as the opioid crisis, because that's a dependence because of trauma?
Absolutely.
Or even worse still, about the suicide rate that happens in Northwest Indiana?
Absolutely. because all of this is usually rooted in distant traumas that people met. I didn't remember some of the traumas in my life, particularly the main trauma, until I was in my 50s. And then it hit me. I had a breakdown, and I had no idea how this could be. But this will help many things. Plus, people who are traumatized feel helpless and hopeless. And this city needs activists. And that's how I came to this. Mm-hmm. Because you can't get people active if they are suffering. You have to give them a hand, help them gain confidence, self-love, self-esteem, and then they can stand up and say, whoa, no more dumps in Gary. Hey, stop those deportations.
That's another point I want to be sure. We only have a couple minutes left here, Ruth, as we have a chance here, too. And you have something that you want to pass along here to keep us, bring us up to date, at least with what seems to be happening at the Gary Chicago International Airport.
Well, the last time I was there, I was impressed by these huge new buildings that the Jet Center managed to put up, most likely with profits made from its deal with ICE. Now, in the last couple weeks, we have seen what ICE does in the separation of not just children, infants, right from the mother's breast, taken away and crying and screaming soundtracks. Now, separation of families at the border is hideous, but it happens every week at the Gary Chicago Airport because a deportation is taking away a father, a son, a brother, a sister, a mother, and veterans and all kinds of other people. So we are looking, there's going to be in Chicago on June 30th part of a nationwide protest against the separation of families. And then following that on July 6th, we will be protesting the separation of families by ICE at the airport where ICE acts and works. One last sentence here. Mm-hmm. I have gotten caught in so many construction slowdowns that I can't even remember when I've been able to get to my destination. But no matter how many construction sites I go by, you know how many black workers I've found? Zero. That means all this construction going on in Gary, and not a single resident of Gary has gotten a job. Those who most need income. You wonder why Gary's in trouble? It's because the people who live here can't find jobs.
Well, and we know that the city administration is trying to do some part and making sure that the contractors toe the line to try to get more people, but they're fighting through it too, I imagine.
Three new buildings at the Gary Airport plus a new customs building going up. How many black workers will you see? Not a one.
Well, Ruth, that's another topic for another day, we hope. Ruth
that's
Needleman,
right.
Who's a Northwest Indiana activist with us today here on the program to talk in particular about the Hope Center, which is a very interesting and very important project.
And if you
project,
want to find out more about it,
yeah,
you can call either the Augustana Lutheran Church in Hobart. I didn't bring the phone number with me, but you can find it online.
Right.
Or you can contact me by email at rneedle@iun.edu, and we will put you in touch, bring you on, and involve you in this fabulous new effort.
Ruth, thanks for being with us again today. And you're listening to Regionally Speaking here on Lakeshore Public Radio. Joshua D is known in the world of PC gaming as behind the number 3 top-earning game on Roblox. It's called Vehicle Simulator. It has more than 100 million play sessions to date. It's probably pushing 200 million right now. We don't know. But we're going to talk with Joshua D. He is a real person. His name is Joshua DeBoer, and he's a 20-year-old from Dyer, Indiana. And he's with us to talk about coming up with this great game that in turn has become so popular. And Joshua, thanks for joining us on Regionally Speaking.
Hey, Chris. Thank you so much. I'm glad I had the opportunity to do this with you also.
Well, tell us a little bit about yourself, about Joshua DeBoer. What got you interested in the games, in the gaming industry, and come up with such an interesting game that has become now so very, very popular?
Pretty much ever since you know, I was obviously young. I always had a thing for video games. I mean, what young man can honestly say that when they were younger that they didn't have an interest in video games? At one point, it honestly kind of became a little bit of an unhealthy obsession for me, where I was spending easily 10 to 12 hours a day playing video games and such. And what kind of got me going with video games is that at a younger age, I had some learning difficulties, and I had some speech and social difficulties, and the doctors said that I had, I was very autistic, and they told my parents I would never speak a word in my life, basically. But my parents, you know, they work with me and such, and here I am now, 20 years later, life is good. But the one thing I always kind of had trouble with was expressing an idea in words. Like, if I had a thought in my head or I had a vision in my head, I didn't have the artistic capabilities to actually draw that out. You know, I couldn't draw a diagram, or I couldn't paint the mental pictures for others and such. So what kind of got me into video games was the fact that I said, hey, I have this idea right here, and there's these tools right here. It's like an easy-to-use canvas with paintbrushes and paint for me, something I can easily understand. Because I've been playing video games all my life. And that's kind of what got me going with actually making video games, was the ability for me to express my thoughts and what I was thinking into a physical format that others could easily interpret. Specifically, at least what got me making video games, I was originally going to be an IT guy. So I was going to work as a systems administrator for whatever company. I went to college for 3 years for that. Regrettably, that college I went to, they went bottoms up for some reason. I went to another college. They got sued and discharged all my loans. So I'm like, all right, this is double or nothing right here. I've kind of got a bad luck streak. You know, I basically have 3+ years in college with no degree due to technical difficulties. I'm like, you know what? I'm going to go do something fun. I used to run a computer repair business. And I used to fix, you know, business computers and consumer computers and such, but I never really clicked with it.
Well, that's a group called Tech Team 911, right?
Yep. Yeah, I used to own that business, so I would actually come out to clients' places, be it business clients or consumer clients. I'd be there within 24 hours to go ahead and fix the issue.
Right.
And the turnaround time, at least, the goal was to have a 24 to 48 hour turnaround time was the goal with that. And, you know, I did that for a long time, and I honestly, it was really enjoyable, and it really taught me valuable business skills and such that I'm actually applying well on the Roblox platform at this point. But what kind of got me into making video games was the fact is, basically, it's like making your own recipe when cooking. You know, you see all these recipes in the cookbook, but you can't find the one that speaks truly to you. And I'm like, I'm looking on Roblox, and I'm like, man, there's no games that are like this. You know, I wanted to make a racing game. You know, I wanted to make something where you could be competitive with friends and such. And eventually I met my business partner one day, his same name is Mikhail, and we kind of hit things off. I worked with his brother previously on a couple small projects and such, and we hit things off, and here we are now. And which is great because we both shared the same vision pretty much, that we both wanted to make a racing game, and we both wanted to make a game that would push the boundaries of what's considered normal in the Roblox industry at this point in terms of technical achievement and gameplay. And it's just really cool that I'm able, you know, we both share the same vision at heart, basically. So that's kind of what got me going into that.
Okay. For listeners who don't know what Roblox is, give us a moment and tell us a little bit about Roblox and how this platform got a chance to give you an opportunity to actually create Vehicle Simulator.
Yeah, absolutely. So Roblox has been around for a long time. I actually just taught a physical course on how to work with Roblox for people who have never used it. But Roblox has been around originally in like the 1990s, if I recall right. It was under another, there was like a prototype of it. The two owners, David Baszucki and Eric Castle, both made a 2D physics engine that was used in school. So the whole point was you could basically say what happens if one block hits another block or a car hits a car. You know, it was used to simulate what physics were like.
Right.
And then back in 2005, Roblox registered this thing. It was called Dynablox, is what it was called. And Dynablox was really open to select few people. Like, you know, it was a closed group that was able to actually test it. In 2006, that's kind of when they officially opened up to the public, and they had only a preset list of games. You couldn't really make your own games back then. You know, it was very limited. There were maybe a couple hundred people playing. But over the years, pretty much, that grew. And now, at least, there's been 11.7 billion hours people have played on Roblox since 2008.
Wow.
There's about 650 plus million hours that people spend on Roblox in a month. At times, especially during the holidays and such, there's been recorded 1.7 million people playing games or interacting with the Roblox site at once. And it's just a really cool platform. A lot of people compare it to Minecraft, and you know, Minecraft is the game where you basically have the building blocks and it's kind of a survival type game and you can play with friends. You know, people are like, oh, Roblox ripped off of Minecraft. And I'm like, the easiest way to compare it is you can make Minecraft in Roblox.
Uh-huh.
That's how powerful their engine is, pretty much. And
wow,
that's the tools they give you are easy to learn. There's not a big learning curve with the tool, but if you invest enough time into it, it's a very powerful engine. There's been some crazy things. But basically, Roblox lets you, the creator, make an idea and publish it to the world or just your friends to play for free. So they give you the tools, they give you the studio to basically build your projects, they give you the web hosting, they take care of the website moderation to make sure that it's a safe community online, they take care of adding new features that you can use in studio to increase the quality of your game, they publish to other platforms, they take care of the advertising, everything. The low cost is $0 per month per year.
Now, I understand that Vehicle Simulator is as you say, it's part of Roblox.com now. It gives you a chance to either to drive or to fly or to sail any number of vehicles, I suppose, planes, boats, cars, and all. Do you think that this is an idea that maybe, along with the fact that it's a great opportunity to come up with something interesting for Roblox, and it maybe it gives people who would love to learn how to fly or love to sail a boat that can't, for whatever reason, give them a chance to actually do so?
You know, it's funny you mentioned that there was another user, I believe he's active now, but he retired a while ago.
Mm-hmm.
His name was Stefan, and he went by the username of CrazyMan32. He was a veteran programmer in the community since the beginning, basically. And I actually looked up to him for the longest time for inspiration because I was always in awe of looking at his work. He specifically made a lot of stuff related to aeronautics. So he was building rockets, he was building planes, he was making dogfighting games, you name it. And I discovered one day when I asked him, you know, he did an interview and he was like, you know, why do you make all these flight simulator type games? And he said basically that, you know, because of my vision, you know, he had vision difficulties and had to wear glasses, that he'd never be able to join, you know, the Air Force and such or fly a plane for real.
Right.
And he said Roblox basically was the opportunity for him to experience what it would actually be like. So I never really thought about it with Vehicle Simulator, but I could agree with that, you know, it's just, it's cool to be able to drive whatever car you want or fly a plane across the island or, you know, you can obviously sail a boat. It's pretty cool. I can totally see that.
Now, Joshua, I have to ask you, since this has become so successful, so popular, is there anything else that is in the works that's on the drawing board right now that can maybe go ahead and follow through on Vehicle Simulator?
We do have a lot of plans in store at this point. We're going to be completely redoing the map because right now it's relatively small. Like it takes maybe 30 seconds to get from point A to point B, with the fastest type of vehicle. So we want to redo the map and we want to make it a lot larger and a lot more detailed overall, is one thing on the drawing boards. We also want to get over to mobile devices in the near future. So we want to be able to play on Apple devices and Android devices, be it phones and tablets. We want to go ahead and publish the game there. Right now you can play it on PC, Mac, and then the Xbox One, but we don't have it on mobile right now, and that's an untapped market. And people have been asking, like, hey, when is Vehicle Simulator coming out to mobile? And it's like, you know, both Mikhail and I were like, shoot, you know, we might as well we better start working on this.
I guess that's the demand. That's your goal. Exactly. I guess is to be able to follow through to make it more accessible to more people. It sounds for sure. So it sounds like this certainly is going to be an opportunity to follow through, and I'm sure probably some other great ideas are going to follow through as well. We've been talking to Joshua DeBoer. It goes by Joshua D. He's known in the world of PC gaming because of the number three top earning game in Roblox called Vehicle Simulator. He's really the vice president and he's the lead programmer for an organization that's called Summa Studio Games. And Joshua is a native of Dyer, Indiana. And Joshua, thanks for talking with us about this great game, your thoughts behind this. And it sounds like that your mom and dad are very proud of you right now.
You know, I wouldn't be where I am without them because, as the doctor said a while back, I literally would not be talking to you right now. I'd basically be a vegetable. So without the support of my friends and family that were really passionate about whatever career choice I was going to make, I definitely wouldn't be here right now. So I'm grateful for them.
Joshua, thanks for being with us today. We appreciate it.
No problem. Thank you so much, Chris.
And that's it for Regionally Speaking for today. I'm Chris Nolte. Thank you for being with us. On tomorrow's program, we have a conversation with the man who's the executive director of the Jesse Brown Veterans Affairs Medical Center in Chicago. Mark McGill will be with us to talk about a very serious topic, veterans suicides. Hope you'll join us.